Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It's program number 763, July 21st, 1986. I'm getting calls and letters from all over the country from various persons who are receiving cassettes that are taken off the air of these programs, which you're supposed to do, tape them and copy them and send to relatives and people that you think would be interested in these particular matters, friends or political people or writers or whatever. But they don't get the source information, the printed sheet that accompanies the broadcast, which is available to that person who is taping it, who originally tapes it. Write to me, Mae Brussel, B-R-U-S-S-E-L-L, P.O. Box 22511, Carmel, California, 93922. Now tell me which tape you have, or put on the envelope any four broadcasts that you want, such as the month of July 1986 or June. I can't put more than four in one envelope, but write to me, and I will send that sheet to you. And then when you make copies for other people, if you think this is important enough to make a copy and buy a cassette and mail it, then it's also important enough to put 22-cent stamp on an envelope and get four bibliography sheets. Copy those at the library or the post office and various places where they have copying machines. And with every tape, just send out this printed sheet that I make up for you so that the recipient of this information, including yourselves who are listening and taping, will have a regular bibliography sheet that you can put in chronological order in a three-hole notebook. And it's very nice to read the sequence of events and follow what I'm saying, because today will be the past, and as we live tomorrow, you can go back and go through these sheets and just see how interesting this material is and how pertinent it is to those things that are going to happen in the future. Now, one quick comment to begin the program with. I read in the San Francisco Chronicle today that in celebration of, not a celebration, remembrance of the death of Elvis Presley, this will be the ninth year, and next year there'll be a large remembrance on the 10th anniversary of his death. The manager from Graceland, Todd Morgan, said that they're going to have, they're contemplating having a very large event, and at that time they will have 200 dancing Statue of Liberty imitators. I thought that was great because I visualized at the time that David Walper put on this horrendous show for the 4th of July that having 200 Elvis Presleys, we'd soon have 1,000 John Lennons and 200 Janis Joplins, and they would take all the murdered musicians and have these massive displays of grossness. So I think it's very funny that the Graceland might have 200 Statue of Liberty imitators for their particular remembrance in a year. There was an article in the paper this morning about the Pope ordering mass in Chihuahua, Mexico. The Catholic bishops there and the church were going to call off mass, to cancel Sunday mass because of a protest of election fraud. Now, what the Catholic bishops want, and they shouldn't be interfering into the government of Mexico, is that they want the recounting of the electoral votes where the PRI party won the last election, and they're pushing for the PAN party, the National Action Party, and the candidate Francisco Barrio, and they claim the elections are fraudulent. And you may be wondering why the United States government is getting into the Mexican election frauds when you think of how John Kennedy won in 1960 and was murdered, and Robert Kennedy would have been the candidate in 1968, and he was murdered, and Ted Kennedy was delivered this Chappaquiddick affair so that he was wiped out as a candidate, and Natalie Stevenson died under mysterious circumstances very quickly after having been with people from the CIA in London, and Senator Frank Church, a candidate for the Democratic Party, had a premature cancer and died, as did Hubert Humphrey, another potential candidate. This country is a disaster in terms of wiping out our electoral possibilities, and even George Wallace was shot just on the eve of his primary victory running against Richard Nixon. The Mexican government has had a ruler law that has been upheld for 60 years, that the church should not interfere with the voting process, that the clergy should not criticize the government, should not participate in laws or officials in public or private in the politics. This is the first time in 60 years that they wanted to cancel the mass this Sunday, and the clergy demand a recount because they are pushing for the PAN party. Now, there was a press conference in Mexico just this last March where there were allegations that Jesse Helms, Senator Jesse Helms, was trying to destabilize the Mexican government, that he was working with our State Department, and that they are singling out the Mexican government because they don't want to put their oil money to pay their national debt. Mexico has a $15 billion a year need to put money into the system to let the people live. They are starving. There's 40 million reaching starvation levels right now. Mexico owes $72 billion in debt to largely the banks of America. And they, by paying this tremendous interest rate, they'd have no money to take care of their own people. And this press conference in Mexico singled out Henry Kissinger, former National Security Council member Norman Bailey, former CIA Director William Colby, who are pushing for a fake democratization. That's what the press conference said. They're saying they want a democracy in Mexico, but they really want the PAN party, which is a fascist party identified with Nazis from World War II and Nazis after World War II. The PAN, the National Action Party, is a fascist organization, and the priests in Mexico and William Colby, former CIA director, and Henry Kissinger and George Shultz are pushing, and Senator Jesse Helms, of course, pushing for a recount on the hopes that they can put a member of the fascist party into power, which they wanted for a long time. The Vatican has interfered into fascist politics in many countries, and the Pope is allowing the bishops and the Vatican officials to take part, but he quickly said he did not want the mass canceled. And so in that sense, he separated himself from that, but the conflicts are still going on. I've been noticing for a long, long time obituaries of very young people, and it seems to be escalating. And I'm asking you world watchers who live in various cities, not close by here, because I take the San Francisco Chronicle and Examiner and the LA Times and the Herald, but outside the California area, to read your obituaries in various states where you live and receive these tapes, and cut out those deaths of young persons, 50 or younger, some of them 60 years of age, and see what they were doing at the time and how they died, and date them and put the newspaper on the corner, and maybe at the end of the month, each month, send me the obituary so I can see what they are. There was an obituary June 3rd in the New York Times of William Damsby, D-A-M-S-B-Y. He had a very versatile acting career. He had a good voice, a baritone with the New York Opera. He died of pneumonia at age 44, and the obituary tells about his working with the New York Opera and playing the role of Judge Turpin in Sweeney Todd, which was interesting because of other actors working with Stephen Sondheim who have died, and he was in well-known operas, but 44 years old, and he died of pneumonia. The reason I bring it up is this morning in the San Francisco Chronicle, there's a Robert M. Cover, 42 years old, Yale University law professor, longtime civil rights leader, died of a heart attack. A member of the Yale faculty club, he refused to take his bar examination until the loyalty oath was taken out of that. He challenged it in court. He's a member of the New York bar and teaches at Yale University. He spent 3 weeks in jail in Albany, Georgia. He went there to work for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and worked for voting rights in the South. 42 years old, heart attack. And then next to that, just today in the San Francisco Chronicle, July 21st, Alfred Luongo. Alfred Luongo, 65, Chief Judge of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, died Saturday. He was appointed to the bench by President John Kennedy in 1961. He was installed as Chief Judge in 1982. Now, I wonder if this presidential appointee is making way for Ronald Reagan's appointments to the courts. He has a good hunk, 40% of all the federal courts to still appoint while he has two more years in office. The Washington Times had an obituary of Thomas Zaker, 54 years old. He died of cancer. He had a master's degree, a doctor's degree. He worked, trained at the Illinois Institute of Technology. He worked in the Defense Department since 1970 and worked on research in the Defense Department. Another person, Steven Reichenberg, died last week, or in June rather, 36 years old, former legislative analyst for the Montgomery County Council, a former budget director of Washington, D.C. City Council. He worked in Washington, D.C., a master's degree, a bachelor and master's degree, Pratt Institute, and he worked on economic and fiscal matters in Washington, D.C., dead at 36. And just one more as an example, Sandra White, former flight attendant, former American airline attendant, died of kidney and liver ailments, 42 years old. She's got an award from the Fairfax County Police Department for superior community service and public safety at 42. There's a 42, a 36, a 54, another 42, a 65, and another 44. And it just seems that these people would have, with their positions of a BA, MA, PhD, and city government, would have access to good medical care. And I find, and I haven't done a whole broadcast on it, but every day I'm finding a lot of people doing a lot of good things, and their obituary seems to say that they were too young to die. And of course, we'll never know the circumstances, but I think it would be interesting for you to start reading the paper in those terms. Now, speaking of dying, G. Gordon Liddy, formerly of the FBI, a district attorney prosecutor in upstate New York, who worked for the Drug Enforcement Agency, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearm, a defendant in the Watergate case, has now opened up his own agency for what he calls security. It's called the Hurricane Force. Many of you probably read it in the newspapers and Time magazine. One article says, terrorism can work both ways. If you want to put out a hit list on selected terrorists, and terrorists, of course, by their definition, it could be a civil rights worker, you know. If you want a hit list, go to G. Gordon Liddy. He now has a 10-man strike force of commandos who will serve your needs. We talk about the security firm of G. Gordon Liddy and Associates and its Hurricane Force, the only private anti-terrorist team that we can think of offhand. They'll work overseas or on domestic turf. This multinational A-team will deliver ransoms, rescue kidnapped corporate officers, coach executives, snoop around new neighborhoods, and check the background of your neighbors. The fee for this excitement is roughly $500,000. He'll throw the boys into work with his simple terrorist capers. But the price goes up with the risks to the James Bond team when he has to call in special equipment and handle those problems. Liddy says American businesses are operating all over the world and there is a terrorism problem. And then the article concludes, get ready. His brochure advises, or get even. Now, another article on G. Gordon Liddy's new security school tells about the 10 people that have signed up in Miami for it. And there's a quotation of Liddy. We had to turn down numerous people who applied because they had previous criminal records. Well, this is a spokesman for Liddy. We wouldn't want a criminal type who could use this knowledge to their advantage. Now, G. Gordon Liddy was a criminal type. He served 6 years in jail and bragged about his efforts or willingness to kill people, so we don't know if he did or has, and was absorbed with Gestapo pictures and Nazi memorabilia and German techniques. So he has opened up the Academy of Corporate Security and Private Investigation, and he already has 10 people ready to go. Time magazine explained that along with his work, he has some trainers, some Israeli people or officials working for him, and out of Miami, he'll have surveillance systems, a 10-man Israeli commando team, and two ex-British commandos. More than 20 would-be sleuths have applied so far for the Miami course. They're learning how to serve him, and they could be runaway people of the CIA because G. Gordon Liddy worked for the Central Intelligence Agency and under the Howard Hughes organization that set up hit teams and death squads with Robert Mayhew as the cover for the Hughes organization. Just 2 weeks ago on June 30th, that was World Watchers program number 760, I was talking about the deaths of people such as Roberta Clemente, the baseball star who was killed in an airplane crash, Don Rogers, football player, Len Bias, the baseball player, the multiple murders in Huntsville Prison in Texas, the hanging of Jacqueline Peters, of Timothy Lee, the murder of Faye Stender, and the relationship of killing blacks and face gender, in this case being a white who is helping blacks. And I also cited, and it's on that biblio sheet, an article called The White Hand that was printed in Penthouse, how over 1,000 CIA trained killers have formed their own Murder Incorporated. Now that's exactly what G. Gordon Liddy is. He's making it legal at this time in the United States of America, advertising hit teams and getting even. And he has this notorious record to fascism and access to all the federal government secrets, and he can be down there in Miami directing this. And this article that was written, The White Hand, by Ernest Volkman and John Cummings, talks about renegade CIA. And this is a perfect example. I had on the air June 30th, and July 3rd, just 4 days later, out comes the article of G. Gordon Liddy's hit team who will help you get even. Now, as soon as Ronald Reagan was in office, well, within 10 months of when he was president, there was an article worldwide was covered throughout the world. One I'm citing is Washington Post, November 19th, 1981. A worldwide private CIA service is planned. U.S. publisher Anthony Stout, backed by large European financial institutions, is building a worldwide intelligence service. It'll be for business and government. It will rival the capabilities of the CIA. The initials for this institute are IRIS. It will be based in the Virginia suburbs. Now, this institute must be 5 years old. And here is G. Gordon Liddy opening up what he calls his own team, but has access to these computers, having been part of the Central Intelligence Agency. The purpose of having it in the United States is that they can be protected through the First Amendment and don't have to discuss their clients and so forth, which they might have to do overseas. They would be throughout the world. They have 33 analysts, which they have now. As I say, this was 5 years ago under the State Department. And the headquarters are in Arlington, Virginia, of course. So this is a private spy agency. And one of the people putting it together was former British Prime Minister Edward Heath. And he will get a salary, or does, of $100,000 to head this International Advisory Committee, which has information on anybody. So if you go to G. Gordon Liddy and want to know who your neighbors are, then this super spy agency, which is as large as the Central Intelligence Agency, it has computer capabilities, it will be electronic, it will be instantaneous, and they can give this information out for people. They have members from Africa, Asia, Latin America, Middle East, United States, and Western Europe, and they will have their own agency, which you call a private, like the Howard Hughes Organization is private, or Hughes Medical Institute, and it's hard to tap into them because of the way it's set up as being a private agency. This is a example of how G. Gordon Liddy can get his information and serve these people who pay $200,000 or $300,000 for that information. Now, this past week, there was an article in the Los Angeles Times, London TV program to feature mock Lee Harvey Oswald trial. There were a group of researchers that put together a play a while back, and now it's coming to London. So it's 23 years since the murder of John Kennedy. The subject is hardly over, and now this play is going to be produced in London, and the London Weekend Television has been negotiating for people to arrange this show, and they want some of the witnesses who testified for the Warren Commission also to help them make the program even more interesting. Oswald will be represented by an empty chair. He was never tried. He was shot 2 days after his arrest. And the program is a documentary exercise, not a dramatized reconstruction of how his interests were not presented in trying to say he was the one who killed John Kennedy. A program in San Francisco called People Are Talking had a one-hour broadcast. It's an ABC station, July the 11th, this past week, and Paul Schrade, who was shot in the Ambassador Hotel the night Robert Kennedy was killed, had put this program on in San Francisco. And it's about exposing the conspiracy behind the murder of Robert Kennedy. The Los Angeles Times is covering a three-part series this week on the conspiracy behind the murder of Robert Kennedy. So London is playing the mock trial of Lee Harvey Oswald. The establishment media is having an interview on the murder of Robert Kennedy. The certainly establishment Los Angeles Times is reopening the case of Robert Kennedy for three consecutive days. So these matters are very, very important, and it's nice that they're coming back to a whole new generation to bring out questions that then they can study and analyze and see how our elections were interfered with. Forget Mexico, if you can, and the accusations that they have inaccurate elections, and think about what's happened to this country and realize that the overthrow of our electoral system is still being examined by writers, historians, and the media, British television, American television, whatever you want, not enough of it yet, but it could keep developing. I want to just update a few items that have to do with the shootout in Beverly Hills, California, where Mr. Skinner, Hugh Skinner, was murdered by the LAPD, and his two hostages were killed also. Three people were killed outside the Van Cleef and Arpels jewelry store. I did some of that a few weeks ago on this program. I just want to cite three current articles to update that. $2.5 million in claims filed in jeweler's death. Claims against Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors and the City of Beverly Hills have been filed for the family and heirs of Hugh Skinner, the manager of the jewelry store. The case is being handled by San Francisco attorney Melvin Belli at behest of Skinner's nephew, Carl Skinner, and his nieces. The reason I chuckle is that Melvin Belli came in when the attorneys for Lee Harvey Oswald's assassin, Jack Ruby, were decided to be not acceptable by the CIA and the federal government, and Melvin Belli became the gentleman who, in quotes, represented Jack Ruby, who was given a full sentence that he tried to appeal and then died before it could be appealed, a death sentence for killing Lee Harvey Oswald. And Melvin Belli steps in when there's a tragedy at Bhopal, when the Korean airline went down. He is very much a person who works on government-related murders and takes a very weird side, but enters into them to help prosecute or the defendant or whatever. So as soon as this series of murders took place in Los Angeles, and I believe it was more than people are saying, and as soon as Mr. Levatitis was arrested and the police killed the manager of the store, Mr. Skinner, in comes Melvin Belli, which is typical. One interesting article from the LA Times regarding the Levatitis case, because all the quotations about him personally come from the military, a member or members of the United States military, and as I said before, there was a stance and a manner in the killing that suggested military training, just as Mark David Chapman appeared to have military training when he killed John Lennon. The Los Angeles Times begins their story, Levatitis, a risk taker, a failure at jobs. That's what we heard about James Earl Ray and found out then he was linked to the Klan and the Nazis and the Mafia and Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby and all the alleged assassins, these loners. These adjectives come in that are a clue. So the article begins, he was a risk taker, a failure at jobs. Stephen Levatitis was a Brooklyn-born Las Vegas kid who couldn't hold a steady job, and he turned with increasing frequency to his older brother, dourly called hustling, and the police called it a crime. He took progressive risks. He often did his acts colored with immaturity. Levatitis came to a tragic conclusion in Beverly Hills on Rodeo Drive, which seemed kind of flaky. That's a quote. This was the recollection of a military officer who dealt frequently with him. After the suspect left New York in late 82 and at age 18 settled in Nevada, a military officer dealt frequently with him from 1982 to 1986. And this article goes on about his arrest and his entering to another jewelry store and taping the people up and sporting a neat mustache and a full beard and his polyester suit and his reptile skin shoes and his appearance in Beverly Hills. But the point is that the person giving the interview about his character is a member of the military. It goes on, at age 18, Levatitis joined the Army Reserve, a step young people take to acquire Army training and to supplement their incomes. After he finishes basic training and his advanced training in Army Reserve, he was in Nevada and he was transferred to a combat support hospital in Las Vegas. Now, the hospital is where the mind control and programming could be, because from Brooklyn he goes to Vegas and begins with his military people who were with him from 1982 to 86 in a military hospital. Within a year, he was terminated from his active status, which reminds me of Oswald being terminated when he went to the Soviet Union officially. He had very poor attendance, according to the army official, who spoke on the condition he not be identified. The source said that while most of the young army reservists are well-motivated, Leviditus exhibited an unusually irresponsible attitude about fulfilling his commitment. A six-foot-tall man who got along pretty well with his peers, no unusual aggressiveness, significant financial problems. Once on occasion, the army official said he came to see me about a late paycheck. This man who worked with Leviditus also was evidently in charge of his money and keeping track of him from 82 to 86. The check was less than $100. He was upset. He was about to burst into tears. And then it goes on, during last May, he lived in an apartment in East Fremont Street, which cuts through the Las Vegas downtown casino district. He had worked as a room service waiter, when you love him as your waiter, other jobs at Las Vegas strip hotels between 1981 and 84, and he was also a cab driver. Now, what the other jobs are like Candy Jones, he was sent from the military hospital to test him on other jobs. They're not specific, but the quotations are from the military. And then there's a quotation about from his brother, who said that he wondered if he would have to change his last name to protect his import business. Now, one final article on Leviditus from the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, June 25th. When Leviditus was bussed in Las Vegas, his mother, a real traditional old Greek lady, flew out from New York to see him. She is the mother was secretary at a Greek Orthodox church near the little Las Vegas motel where Leviditus' mother stayed. This is a quotation of Patsy Molina, secretary at a Greek Orthodox church. Now, the Greek Orthodox church brought Palestinians and Muslim family and made them part of the Greek Orthodox church, known as the Sirhan family, and moved them from Palestine when it became Israel to New York and to Pasadena. And the rest is history. They were brought into that area by friends of Richard Nixon through the Greek Orthodox Church. Marina Oswalt's funding, her money, her associations in Dallas, the taking care of the birth of her second child, feeding the first one, and taking care of her while Oswalt was on his various jobs and missions was the Greek Orthodox Church. So a lady in Las Vegas, Patsy Molina, secretary to Greek Orthodox Church, was describing Leviticus's mother. Now, his mother, it divides her time between New York and Athens, Greece. She was stunned to learn that her boy had his first brush with the law in Las Vegas. He had come to Vegas in 82, was working with the army, and then it goes on to say that he was arrested for stealing computers, and then it appears 1984 he burglarized two computer stores. In the burglaries, about $40,000 in merchandise was taken. He pleaded guilty to possessing stolen goods. He was given the 5 years of suspended sentence I mentioned before. Later, in July 1985, he was again arrested, possession of drugs with intent to sell. He wasn't prosecuted on the cocaine charges because there was more than one person involved, and they let him go. 2 months later, the police arrested Leviditus for firing a gun into an occupied building. The charges were dismissed for lack of evidence by the deputy chief of police of Nevada and the Department of Parole and Probation. Last November 8th, the state parole and probation officers picked him up for violation of parole. A parole revocation hearing was set for January 23rd. He disappeared and didn't show up, and he wasn't sought for. He was still in Vegas. They also had another burglary that they suspected he did in a jewelry store. February 2nd of 1986, there was a daring robbery. Daytime robbery where people were locked up, tied up. He escaped with $250,000 in jewelry. And less than a month later, the police suspected it was him. And there were warrants out on 5 counts of robbery, deadly weapon, coercion with a deadly weapon. And he was not brought in. He was living right in Las Vegas in what they call Glitter Gulch, among the casinos and so forth. And then moved to Los Angeles, where he had a $600 a month apartment. And he had no verifiable employment history when he was in Los Angeles. And he was picked up on Rodeo Drive with a 1971 Plymouth with Nevada plates on Rodeo Drive, May 19th, before the shootout. And the police let him go. They could have put a search and found the cocaine charges, the robbery charges, the jewelry store, allegations, the computer stuff that was sold. He had a long record in Las Vegas and a man who was close to him. The only personal person giving any interview was the secretary of the Greek Orthodox Church or the army spokesman who was in contact with him and his money and knew that he was at an army hospital in Las Vegas. So much for that account of the burglary murder in Beverly Hills that I believe he went specifically to get Mr. Skinner or produce him, and the SWAT team killed him. And Nancy Reagan, as I had on the year before, stayed at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel across the street, one block away from where all this was happening. I'll take a 1 minute break now and update some other news for you, just as bad, but I hope interesting. This is Mae Brussel, and we'll continue in 1 minute.